Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keyes. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. Oh, and we have a Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes group, and I suggest that you do that, join that, because that seems to get announcements out faster. People are hearing about things better on the group than on the page. So I would suggest you join the group. And also you can talk to other fans, and also I'll be doing special giveaways on the group page that I won't be doing on the, you know, regular page. You can also check me out on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keyes, and you can email me, saturdayswithjoykeyes@hotmail.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know this is not our normal day, but I have a special guy on here. He is an author of the narrative nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, which was a number one New York Times bestseller, and the poetry collection, Counting Descent, which won the 2017 Literary Award for Best Poetry Book from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, and was a finalist for the NAACP Image Award. You probably have seen his essays, poems, and writings in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, Poetry Magazine, The Paris Review, The Harvard Educational Review, and elsewhere. In 2014, he was a National Poetry Slam champion, and in 2017, he was a recipient of the Jerome J. Shestack Prize for the American Poetry Review. He also has TED Talks, and he's the host of a YouTube series, Crash Course Black American History. What can he not do? Well, I think he told me he can't cook, but, I mean, that's just a small minor detail. Welcome, Clint Smith, or Dr. Smith. Good evening.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you again for coming on this evening in the midst of, I guess, we're still in a pandemic. How are you and your family handling this pandemic? Because now it seems to be extending itself with this new variant.
Yeah, excuse me. I think like everyone, it's been a trying year and a half. You know, I was just looking at a video of my kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old I think it was day 12 of the pandemic, when for some reason I thought this thing would only last a few weeks or a few months. At most, and they were so small compared to you know, how they look now, and I was like, wow, we've really lived through like an extended period of time. I mean, my 2-year-old, you know, 3/4 of her life has been in this pandemic, you know, and essentially like in this house. So it's I love my kids more than anything. I also was not psychologically or emotionally prepared to spend more than a year in the house with them 24 hours a day. So,
yeah.
You know, my 4-year-old is back in preschool, and my 2-year-old will be starting in the fall. So we're doing all right. I think, you know, we're in this sort of strange space where, like, my wife and I are vaccinated, but the kids obviously are not because they're too young. And so, you know, with this variant, it's unsettling. And hopefully we are getting close to whatever the worst of it is, so that we can start to move out of it. But you know, we're doing all right. All things considered, we are we're doing fine. And, you know, I always am thinking of the people who you know, have the frontline jobs and who are far more at risk. Than we are.
Definitely. Do you think a book of poetry is going to come out of this COVID? Like, COVID, you know, the year I lost my mind. What would the title be of your COVID poetry book?
If I were going to do a COVID poetry book, it would probably be about COVID parenting. And it would probably just be like day one. Oh, this isn't too bad. Day 37. I'm beginning to lose my mind. Day 372. I'm a wilting, you know, pile of despair. I actually do have a collection of poetry that should be coming out in another year or two about parenting, or not parenting, but like about being a father to young children. And it's a very different sort of emotional tenor than this last book. You know, this you know, filled with kind of like poems that are like ode to the spit up. So it's a change of pace, but I was writing it almost as alongside the how the word is passed, because it was just a sort of respite from, you know, thinking about intergenerational chattel bondage all day. So that should be out in a little bit.
I have to tell you, you know, the book was difficult. Of course, it made me angry. It made me sad. I had to, like, stop. I couldn't, like, read. I would try to read. I was trying to, like, you know, go through the book and read a couple chapters, but I really couldn't, because it was just, it exhausted me. And so I had to go and, like, watch something, like, goofy, like, Stargate 1 or, I don't know, you know, just do something else, because I needed a break from the truth. You know, I think your book is trying to tell the truth, and that is the point, because we don't know the truth. We're hidden from the truth. We've been spoon-fed propaganda. But I have to tell you, it's just a little difficult. But before we get to the book, I heard about your color gray poem. What's up with the color gray poem? Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, I grew up a hater of the color gray. So when people ask me what is the first poem I can remember writing, it is this poem about the color gray that I think I wrote. Well, it must have been third grade, and I think it went, I hate the color gray. It reminds me of a rainy day. Gray, I really hate that color. It's annoying, like my little brother. You know, shout out to my little brother who I love dearly, but who I apparently was very annoyed with when I was a third grader. And yeah, I remember writing that poem and having my third grade teacher come up and put her hand on my shoulder and look over my shoulder at the poem, and she looked at me and she said, "Clint, you can be a writer when you grow up." And then, you know, she walked on to the next kid. And for all I know, she could have said that to every kid in the room. She could have said it and completely forgotten after. But that moment stayed with me for the rest of my life. And I will always remember Miss Mueller saying, "You can be a writer when you grow up." And it is hard for me to disentangle the fact that I've become a writer from somebody naming that as a possibility when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And I think for me it was a moment both as in the context of being an educator. You know, I taught high school English for a few years and then also continue to teach in jails and prisons now, that you never know how what you say is going to impact somebody. And that's general, but certainly as an educator, you never know how something you say to a student will stay with them, even if it was something that you weren't really cognizant of. And that, you know, lesson stayed with me for a long time and continues to.
Yeah, I remember certain teachers. As a matter of fact, one of my teachers from elementary school, she passed, and I had gone to her funeral, and it was just amazing that I still remembered her. I remembered things she said to me. I remember going to a retirement of another teacher, and I remember she was teaching us like Swahili and all these things that were like really ahead of time. It was a black woman. And, you know, I didn't realize how unique that was until, of course, I grew up and, you know, spoke to other people. And they're like, she was doing what in the eighth grade? Like, you know, education and teachers are so important. And that's like your book, again, talking about the truth. I heard that you are calling yourself an incarceration scholar. What does that mean? Can you tell the audience?
Yeah, well, my PhD, for my PhD dissertation, I studied the relationship between education and incarceration. So I got my PhD at Harvard in 2020 and was thinking a lot about what education means to people specifically who have been incarcerated. You know, I have, like I said, I've been teaching in prison for the past 7 years or so, and I'm deeply interested in how someone who has been told they are going to spend the rest of their lives in a cage make meaning of what education is and what the purpose of education could be in their lives. And so, you know, this book is not specifically about incarceration, but it's certainly informed by my work, having been trained by scholars and sociologists and thinkers who, historians who were centering the story of incarceration in their work. And, you know, I think the reason I have a chapter like Angola in my book that focuses on Angola prison is because so much of my curiosity has been shaped by that time, you know, all those years spent working in the prison and working with scholars who made that a central focus of their own work.
That was a tough chapter, and that was one of the ones that really made me like angry. But the funny, crazy psycho thing was the Angola gift shop, and I thought that should have been in the Quentin Tarantino movie. I mean, I could totally see that, because I was like, when you were describing the different items that were in there, but then on the other side, you have this conversation about the Red Hat cell. Can you tell the audience about what was going on in the Red Hat cell block?
Yeah, so for some broader context, Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country. It is 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. It is a place where 75% of the people held there are black men. Over 70% of them are serving life sentences. And it is built on top of a former plantation. And what I tell folks is that if you were to go to Germany, and you have the largest maximum security prison in Germany, and it was built on top of a former concentration camp, most of the people held there were disproportionately Jewish, that place clearly and rightfully be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. It will be abhorrent. It will be disgusting. We would never allow anything like that to exist. It is so clearly run counter to our moral and ethical sensibilities. In the U.S., we have the largest maximum security prison in the country. It incarcerates black men serving life sentences who go out into fields of what used to be a plantation and get back to virtually no pay while someone watches over them on horseback with a gun over their shoulder. And so part of what I'm thinking when I go to Angola is, what are the ways that the history of white supremacy not only physical violence against people in violence, but also people in India to...
Wait a second, Clint, you kind of went out a little bit. Could you say that again?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just saying part of what I'm exploring is what happens, you know, what are the ways that not black people have not only experienced physical violence, but also the ways that certain institutions reflect a different type of violence and a sort of numbness to a type of violence that we collectively have as Americans that in another global context would so clearly be unacceptable. And I think that the gift shop at Angola is an additional layer of absurdity, you know, to that institution, where you have the largest prison in the country that sells coffee mugs and shot glasses and you know, T-shirts and sweatshirts and baseball caps adorned with things that say Angola, a gated community, as if to make a mockery of the conditions that millions, that thousands of people are continuing to live through today.
Yeah, that was just like, I already knew about Angola, but then of course, you know, when you read things and it just brings up other feelings. The gift shop to me, I was like, this is a movie. I'm just sorry. I just started thinking about a movie. You also went to about seven other places. One of the places you went to was the Whitney Plantation. And you talked about the federal writers. I thought that was really, I did not know about that, and I'm sure many of our listeners may not. Could you tell them about the Federal Writers Project?
Yeah, so the Federal Writers Project was part of a larger New Deal initiative in the late 1930s. It lasted from 1936 to 1938. And part of what it did was collect oral histories across the country, and there was a specific focus on the oral histories of formerly enslaved people. And so they collected about 2,300, conducted about 2,300 interviews with people who had been born into slavery and who were still alive in the late 1930s. And it is this remarkable sort of treasure trove of information that provides, I think, really important insight into what slavery was like for millions and millions of people. And part of why it's important, despite some of the very real limitations that it has, because some of the people who were conducting the interviews were themselves racist and would sort of caricature and stereotype the language that that some of the formerly enslaved folks were using, and you know had their own set of ideological motivations about how they wanted some of these people to appear. So there are limitations to some of them, and so many of these were done differently across different states that there are some inconsistencies. But still, I think part of what scholars are realizing is that this is so valuable because for many people, the only narratives, first-person accounts and testimonies that we get, that many people across this country get of enslaved people is people like Frederick Douglass or, you know, if you're lucky, Olato Equiano or Harriet Jacobs, and stories of people like Harriet Tubman. And the thing about Frederick Douglass, for example, is that it is important to study the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. It's important to read his memoirs, his autobiography. And, you know, I've read all of them. But it's also important to remember that Frederick Douglass is not reflective of the vast majority of enslaved people. Like, the vast majority of enslaved people did not escape, did not learn to read and write, did not become world-famous writers and orators, did not live mm-hmm. in a state that was in any way proximate to their, he lived in Maryland, so it was proximate to the North in ways that would even facilitate them being able to escape. And so if you only study people like Frederick Douglass, then you can fall into the trap of thinking that there were a lot of enslaved people like Frederick Douglass when that wasn't the case. And part of what the Federal Writers Project does is allow us to really sit with the daily quotidian nature of what slavery was like for millions of ordinary enslaved people in the way that, you know, millions of us are ordinary and just people who are trying mm-hmm. to make a life and create purpose and create meaning and value in their lives in the face of circumstances that are just unfathomable. And it has these small moments that show this sort of reclamation of agency in the face of an institution that is trying to consistently take that away. These small moments where you have people who are dancing together in barns on a Saturday night as respite from their work, people who are little kids who are skipping rocks across a creek, two people falling in love who are trying to hold hands under the shade of a tree while the overseer looks in the other direction. Just these small, important moments that remind you that these were people, that these were humans.
Yeah, you have a lot of stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. I think we have a caller here. Let me see if they have a question. Your number's ending in 1695. Do you have a question for Clint?
Peace and blessings. My name's Romeo DiNazzi. I do not have a question. I'm just enjoying the show. I had the chance to check out the YouTube series. So I'm just interested in just listening. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in, though, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Absolutely.
So talking about these ordinary people, you have a chapter that's dealing with Juneteenth, and there's a gentleman, Gates. Can you talk to the audience about what he was able to do or start, in relation to Juneteenth?
Yeah, so Jack Yates was a formerly enslaved man who moved to Houston with his family and is one of the people who founded a community of formerly enslaved people in Houston in the Third Ward that became a centerpiece of Black Houston culture. And also they founded and created Emancipation Park, which is one of the first parks in the state of Texas. And the site continues to be the site of Juneteenth celebrations every year, and was founded as this sort of place for formerly enslaved folks to come together and be in community and eat and dance and sing and celebrate their freedom in ways that laid the groundwork for Juneteenth. These are some of where the first Juneteenth celebrations would take place. And Houston, you know, is 45 minutes or an hour away from Galveston, Texas, where in 1865, in June 19th of 1865, General Gordon Granger of the Union Army came down with his troops and told 250,000 enslaved people in Texas that they were free, that they had been freed in the Emancipation Proclamation 2 years prior, that the Civil War had effectively been over since April of 1865, when General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox. And that information was kept from hundreds of thousands of people whose enslavers were intended for them to be kept in the dark with regard to this information. And so, you know, now Juneteenth is this moment where we there's a sort of both-andedness to it. We both celebrate the fact that we have this moment to mark the end of one of the worst things that this country has ever done, perhaps the worst thing this country has ever done next to Native genocide and removal. And then you also have the mourning of the fact that this information was kept from, you know, so many people for so long and done so in an insidious and intentional way. And so, you know, Jack Yates, I had the opportunity to interview his great-granddaughter, and she was talking about the way that she learned about who he was and the tradition, the oral history that had been passed down through her family about who this man mm-hmm. was, who was central not only to her family but to the sort of greater Black Texas community.
Yeah, that was, again, you can always learn, and I've done so many shows and authors and things, and I'm still learning, and so that's why I think your book is so important. It's talking about, you know, constantly questioning and delving into learning more about situations, particularly that the North, you know, was a great land of freedom for Africans, slaves, but that's not the case. You're telling us that Wall Street and the bank were entangled. Can you tell the audience how banks and Wall Street were entangled with this idea of slavery or actually the act of holding slaves? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Wall Street and the banks and financial institutions of New York were the entities that funded and provided capital to the enslavers and plantation owners in the South. I mean, that is who provided them with the credit, with the capital, with the insurance, with the resources needed to keep the slaveocracy of the South going in the way that it did. And, you know, part of why I wanted to include a chapter like New York is to make clear to people who might not be familiar that New York was, you know, as in so many places in the North, were central, not only in financing the institution of slavery, but directly participating in it. Many people don't know that for many years, you know, New York City was the second largest slave market in the country after Charleston, South Carolina, that in 1861, on the brink of the Civil War, the mayor of New York City, Fernando Wood, attempted to convince the rest of New York City to secede from the Union because New York's financial, social, and political infrastructure and interests were so deeply entangled in slavery in the South. And so he wanted to secede alongside South Carolina and Alabama and all of these states that were beginning to secede in 1861. And that was so revelatory for me, you know, because I, like the mayor of New York City, wanted to secede from the Union, because the way that we talk about history is often in such generalized, blanketed, cleanly demarcated ways that don't mm-hmm. reflect the complexity of actual history, right? That there were, yeah. And New York City was, New York was a Union state, you know, but there were also a lot of Confederate sympathizers throughout New York. In the same way that Texas was a Confederate state, there were a number of Union sympathizers there, right? So I think even the way that we talk today about red states and blue states doesn't reflect the complexity of those states. You know, California might be a blue state, but 40% of the people there are Republican or have conservative views. And so sometimes we can sort of erase the complexity of places by attempting to say they were union or just union or Confederate or just red or blue. And part of what I think is important is to lean into the complexity of so many of these places and recognize that there's a real heterogeneity within them that sort of complicates a lot of the stories we'd otherwise tell of who these places are.
Yeah, you know, I think human nature, we're complex. We're not all bad. We're not all good. I mean, that's what is so hard. There's this dissonance, difficulty to mesh, like, how can somebody, you know, be a serial killer but then help the old lady every day with her groceries? You know, we just can't, like, get that. You know, we think of, you know, the serial killer as this big, bad, evil person, you know, but that's not the case. Human beings are not built that way. And like you said, in terms of politics, I mean, they had a Republican governor, you know, over in California, which is supposed to be like, you know, hey, peace and love. So you're correct in that. Also in your book, you're talking about Thomas Jefferson, one of the people in history that is looked at in a certain way, but that's not the truth. I don't want to give everything away. So everybody, I'm going to be giving away some copies of your book. But I want to talk about some food here. We only have a couple minutes. You told me you can't cook, but you can eat. So what's your favorite dish? What can you eat from New Orleans,
you know,
or Maryland?
What's your dish? I'm a son of New Orleans and a current resident of Maryland. So, I love jambalaya. I love dirty rice. I love gumbo, crawfish etouffee, you know, just like shrimp po' boys. Some of the hometown classics, red beans and rice. I mean, I could eat that all day. That's what I grew up on. And here in Maryland, you know, I put Old Bay on way too many things at this point. I need to calm down because I think Old Bay seasoning is as good as it gets compared to.
Do you carry it around in your back pocket, like, you know, like hot sauce in the pocketbook of a woman?
I mean, you know, I've only been in the house for a year and a half, so I don't even have to carry it around because it's always downstairs in my pantry. So, you know, when I start actually going places, it'll, you know, we'll see if I carry it. I probably will try not to do that because I'll feel like that's a little too much. But I did do that for Tony Sacheries for a long time. I would carry Tony Sacheries with me, little packets of Tony Sacheries from New Orleans everywhere I went. And then I was like, nah, I'm in my 30s now. I can't be doing that anymore. I'm not 18.
So funny. Oh, my gosh. What's up next for you? You wrote this book. What are you going to be doing next? Another book, poems, teaching? What's up next?
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of this ongoing series right now called Crash Course Black American History. If you look it up on YouTube, you can find it, Crash Course Black American History. And we're doing 50 episodes of sort of semi-animated episodes on that are like 10 minutes long about different parts of Black history. So I think we've released 10 or 11. And so, you know, we did one on Phyllis Wheatley. We're going chronologically. So, you know, transatlantic slave trade. And then there was one about Phyllis Wheatley, about the Fugitive Slave Act, about now, you know, we're moving into Reconstruction. We're moving into, out of the Civil War and into Reconstruction, early days of Jim Crow, Harlem Renaissance. And so we're kind of chronologically moving through Black history. And I hope that, you know, it can be an entry point to this history for some folks who might not, have the time or resources for whatever reason to, read a book. Or hopefully it serves as an entry point to folks wanting to read some of these books, you know, whether it be mine or so many of the other scholars who've written beautifully and extensively on these topics.
I mean, books are amazing. They take you places that you may not be able to go because of money or resources. And now you can download a lot of books electronically from libraries all across the country, like, as long as you have your library card. So you don't have to even go to the library to pick up, quote unquote, a book. But thank you, Clint, for writing this book, making it an entry point. And one of the key things I thought was that slavery may have been a couple hundred years ago, but you really have to think about it in generations. And I've been saying that, I'm telling you, I've been saying that forever and ever, generationally, that it's, you can't think about the hundreds of years, but think about the numbers of generations, that there are people alive that were related to a slave, like a daughter of a slave, for example, with the woman who helped open the African American Museum in Washington, D.C. So thank you for writing the book. I hope that you come back when you have another project. And please be safe with this new variant of COVID. Ah!
Likewise. You too. Thank you so much for having me, and be safe.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this evening. I'm going to be giving some copies away of Clint Smith's book. So you want to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also check out the show on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. So if you missed the beginning of this interview, no worries. All of the shows are archived. So just come back in a couple minutes on one of those platforms. You'll be able to listen to the show. I hope you guys have a great week. I'm going to be doing a show, two shows on Saturday. Author Joel McNally, and also author Marita Golden. We're going to be talking about Alzheimer's with her. So tune in Saturday, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. You guys have a great week and be safe. And I hope you tune in Saturday.
Adopt U.S. Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.